Well, today we've come to our penultimate message on walking with God, and I hope you remember what the writer of the Hebrews says. He says, therefore, brothers, that includes the ladies, therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart, in full assurance of faith. Christian friends, let us draw near to God, says the writer, in full assurance. Through Jesus, we can freely enter God's presence anytime, anywhere. We can get our souls to God. We can live within the curtain, within the veil. We can again walk with God in the garden. Through Christ, the bridge between heaven and earth has been rebuilt. There's no flaming sword, no wrath to drive us away, only the assurance of a wonderful welcome in Christ. And therefore it's our joy, the privilege beyond all privileges, to walk with God. And as we do, we discover that the fellowship with God is not a means to an end, but is the end itself. It's heaven on earth. Well, last Sunday we looked at the impact of walking with God, and we discovered three things. We discovered that if you have a closer walk with God, it will break you. If you have a closer walk with God, then you will have a new vision of Jesus, and it will transform you to be like him. And if you walk with God, it will make you heavenly minded. If you missed last week, if you want to revise what we thought about, it's all on the web or on the CDs. Do please listen to it. This morning, we're going to think about two further results of a closer walk with God. So this morning, very simply, two points. And the first is number one, or if you're adding it to what we said last week, number four, usefulness. Christian friend, do you want your life to count for Jesus? Then you must walk with God. So two case studies, one man and one woman. So first off, we're going to think about the man, Joshua. Now, Joshua succeeds Moses as Israel's leader, and he is faced with a colossal challenge because he's got to lead the children of Israel into the promised land. So how does God prepare Joshua for his life's work? How does he equip him for the task that he's facing? And maybe those of you who aspire to lead, how might God be equipping you? So how does God equip him for this task of leadership? Well, number one, God lets him feel the misery of Egypt. Joshua grows up in the land of slavery. He grows up in the far country. So he doesn't need persuading to go to the promised land, whatever the difficulties. There's no arm twisting necessary. You wouldn't find Joshua grumbling about how hard it is to serve the Lord. Not when he's been on the treadmill of Egypt. And number two, God throws Joshua into dangerous and threatening situations so that he can learn the art of warfare. So come with me to Exodus chapter 17. And the Amalekites are always snapping at the heels of Israel. And so it's time for a showdown. And so Exodus chapter 17 and verse 9. And Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. So there's Moses on top of the hill, when his hands are up, Israel prevails. When his hands are down, Amalek prevails. What's going on? What's the lesson? Well, when Moses' hands are held high, it's a token that they have the Lord over them, above them, fighting for them. And that's made explicit as we read on, verse 12. But Moses' hands became heavy, so they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. Joshua's got to hear all about this. Write it down, tell him. The art of warfare, the Lord is my banner. Now, in the old days, when armies went to war, the king would lead his people to battle. He would go ahead of his army. And when he went into battle, he would have with him his battle standard. And his army would rally, would gather around the battle standard, his flag, his banner. And so as his troops fought, as they're on the field of battle, they'll be able to look up and they'll be able to see the king's banner. And when they saw the king's banner, they knew that the king was on the field with them, that he was fighting for them. The king was with them on the field of battle. And they kept looking, and there was the banner, and they kept looking. And as long as he was with them, as long as when they looked up, they knew his banner hadn't fallen, they knew the battle wasn't lost. Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. See the lesson. Joshua learns that no battle need ever be lost, provided we fight in the king's name, provided we gather around his battle standard, we gather around his banner. Because it's the Lord who fights for us. And his banner will never fall. We're on the victory side. That's what he's to learn. Good lessons, aren't they? Those of you aspiring to lead, are you learning them? And number three, God chooses Joshua as one of the 12 spies to survey the land of Canaan. Now, it's going to be a responsibility. It's going to test him. It's going to test his diligence, his initiative, his trustworthiness. But it's going to test much more than that, isn't it? Because those spies come back and tell them, give a bad report to the people. And when they do, what does Joshua say? Numbers chapter 14. 10 come back with a bad report. Oh, it's a great land, but the people are giants. We're grasshoppers. We'll never be able to conquer them. Numbers 14, verse 7. He and Caleb stand up. They withstand the bad report. And this is what they say. The land we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Great counsel, isn't it? Well, what's the response of the children of Israel? Verse 10, and the congregation said to stone them with stones. So Joshua is not afraid to stand alone. Leadership sometimes means standing alone. Had Joshua sought to find a consensus, had they done it by a vote, had it been a democracy, it would have been a disaster, wouldn't it? Leadership sometimes means standing alone, saying unpopular things, confronting people, reminding them of the promises of God. And Joshua is the man who sees the Lord when they don't. He's the man who's confident in the promise of his word when the others are not. He's therefore a man who is unafraid of costly obedience. And did you notice? He's a man who's now seen the promised land. So he knows what he's fighting for. And number four, God makes Joshua Moses' right-hand man. So he must have a teachable spirit, young man. And of course he's learning from Moses. He's learning from the best. So this servant-hearted man witnesses at first hand how to lead the people of God. And again, that's how we raise up leaders. So Joshua, he's seen the misery of Egypt. He's seen the glory of the promised land. He's learned the art of warfare, that we fight under the Lord's banner. The Lord is over us. We're on the Lord's side. That's the secret of victory. And he's following in the footsteps of Moses. But it's not enough. For all his experience and teachableness and evident gifts, it's not enough. There's something more. What is it? Exodus 24. So men who aspire to lead, are you listening to this? Exodus 24, we're at Sinai. You remember at Sinai, God recreates the holy mountain. It's where heaven and earth meet. Of course, now when heaven and earth meet, there's fire and darkness because there's a holy heaven and a cursed earth. But heaven and earth meet, there's a temporary bridge. And what do we read? Exodus 24, verse 12, then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and commandments which I have written, that you may teach them. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back to you. This is the man who goes up the holy mountain with Moses. This is the man who walks on the holy mountain with God. Exodus 33. It's post-Sinai. And if you remember, we now have a stylized holy mountain that's been laid on its side. The tabernacle. And what do we read? Exodus 33, verse 11. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend, and he would return to the camp. But his servant, Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. This is the man who seeks the unveiled presence of God. So what is it that equips Joshua for this mighty task? Got to lead the children of Israel into the promised land. What is it? What is it that qualifies him for that? It's one thing and one thing supremely. He is the man who walks with God. Which is why when they're about to enter the promised land, God says to Joshua, chapter 1 of Joshua, verse 9, I need to turn to it. God says, have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Having sought the face of God, having lived in the immediate presence of God, having been the man who walks on the holy mountain, whether it's Sinai or whether it's in the tabernacle, God's promises that he will be with him. And it is God's presence with him that will equip Joshua for everything that lies ahead. It is God's presence with him that will maximize Joshua's usefulness. But you see, the point is this. It's a presence, a nearness, which Joshua has cultivated throughout his life. This is not something that happens just before the promised land. It's been going on for the last 40 years. The man who walks with God, the man who stays in the tabernacle, the man who cultivates his fellowship with God, so that when the time comes, and God says, I'll be with you, it's a presence he has always sought. He's not, as it were, jumping rails, stepping into something different. It is the next step of a life that's been lived in fellowship with God. So do you want your life to count for Christ? Maybe you aspire to lead. Well, are you doing your arithmetic? Are you learning the lesson? Well, on to our second example. Not a strategic leader or a mighty warrior, but no less useful. Dorcas. So let's go to the reading which we had. Acts chapter 9. Now, who is Dorcas? Chapter 9, verse 36. At Joppa, there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which is translated Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and charitable deeds, which she did. That's who she is. She's full of good works, full of charitable deeds, acts of kindness. Now, in our back garden, we have three fruit trees. And this year, the pear tree produced one pear, which fell off. The apple tree produced two apples. And the plum tree, every branch, high branches, low branches, the lot, they were laden with ripe, sweet, juicy plums. Well, that's Dorcas. She's full. High branches, low branches, everything. She's full of good works, full of acts of kindness, charitable deeds. Her whole life is overflowing with good works, and the blessings just ripple out to the many. So when tragedy strikes and she dies, people are heartbroken. And when Peter arrives, everyone's holding in their hands what she did for them. Verse 39. And Peter rose and went with them. When he had come, they brought him to the upper room, and all the widows stood by him weeping and showing the tunics and the garments. So undergarments and overgarments, which Dorcas had made while she was with them. It's a very moving scene, isn't it? You think of Peter, he's a big bear of a man, isn't he? You know, Jesus says to him, when you were young, Peter, you could go wherever you wanted. No one would ever stop you. You never got in, no one ever stood in Peter's way. He's the man, John 21, who when they come to pull in that net with 153 big fish, it's Peter who's pulling in the nets. And how tall he was, but he's a big man. He's a bear of a man. So can you see the scene? There's Peter, big man. And yet he's surrounded, and they're probably about sort of chest high. All these widows, they're all sort of gathering around him. And if you came in the room, you see big Peter, and there's like all these widows all around him, weeping. And they're holding up to Peter these undergarments and overgarments, which Dorcas had made for them. Last year in Sri Lanka, when Rajendram died, we were in Muttur, and there was Mahendran, and Mahendran is tall for a Sri Lankan. And he was surrounded by all these broken-hearted widows. And they were all stretching out their hands towards Mahendran. They all wanted to be close. They all needed to be touched and comforted. It's very moving to see it, very moving. You get the sense of the scene, don't you? There's Peter, and they're all holding these things, and they're all stretching. They just want to be together. They want to be close. But it speaks of a wonderful testimony, doesn't it? The wonderful testimony that Dorcas had. So she may not be a Joshua leading the nation, but she's no less precious. She may not be a great warrior. After all, she makes underwear and overgarments. But is her service for the Lord any less valued? She did what the Lord gave her to do, and she did it to the full. So much so that she's made herself indispensable. In the sense that she's far too valuable to be taken yet. Verse 40. But Peter put them all out and knelt down and prayed. And turning to the body, he said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes. And when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand and lifted her up. And when he had called the saints and widows, he presented her alive. Wonderful, isn't it? Wonderful. Her life was full of good works. and says, God, those good works haven't finished yet. There's more for her to do. She's far too useful. And the Lord restores her to life. Well, maybe you think as we're going through this, okay, but it doesn't say anything about her walking with God. Well, what do we read? Verse 36, this woman was full of good works. Now, who went about doing good? Just a few verses later, Acts 10, verse 38, Peter is preaching to the household of Cornelius. This is what he says about Jesus. Verse 38, God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power, who went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. Jesus went about doing good, for God was with him. Here is Jesus' disciple, Dorcas. It's a life that's full of good. Implication, God is with her. This is obviously a woman who walks with God. And it's because God is with her that she is so useful. That's what makes her count. God is with her. And she's so useful, he brings her back to finish the work he's given her to do. So, Christian friends, have you learned the lesson? Usefulness. Do you want to maximize your usefulness for the Lord? Do you want to be up and doing for Jesus? Do you want your life to count for Christ? Well, maybe like Joshua, the Lord is calling you to lead. So like Joshua, the Lord will put you in dangerous situations. Because it's only in those dangerous situations that you will learn the art of spiritual warfare. You will learn how to wield the sword of the Spirit. You will learn how to conquer in prayer as you fight under the Lord's banner. And if he's calling you to lead, then Christian friend, he will call you to costly obedience. And sometimes it will be lonely obedience. You might find yourself with just a Caleb standing with you and seemingly the whole nation against you. And you'll find yourself saying, we must do this. This is right. It's for the glory of God, when you're surrounded by a sea of discouragers. And like Joshua, the Lord will make you serve an apprenticeship. So you must be teachable. Talking with a pastor friend, not so far from here. He's got some young men in this church, and the headaches they cause him because they're not teachable. They see themselves as God's gift. I'm the blessing. Use me. But they're not teachable. See, they can't be used. Be teachable, be servant-hearted. And like Joshua, God will give you a sight of the promised land. So you know what you're fighting for. And you'll have seen Egypt, and you've seen the promised land. And you'll say, Egypt, the promised land. It's obvious what we should do. But supremely, if you are to lead, then you must walk with God. You need God with you. So where will you get that? Direct from God. For all your gifts, experience, opportunities, it will come to nothing unless you humbly, continuously, day by day, seek the face of God. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. You see, it's God's presence, a presence that Joshua has cultivated these 40 years, a presence that he sought. It's God's presence that equips us for all that we must face if we're to lead the people of God and to finish the work he's given us to do. God's presence. Maybe, Christian friend, your calling is very different. You're not being called to lead in that way. But one thing you can guarantee, Ephesians 2 verse 10, is that God has prepared for you good works beforehand, that you should walk in them. There's no problem with good works. God's prepared them for you. So you can live a life of good works. So will you be a pear tree with one pear that drops off? Or will you be a plum tree? Will you be like Dorcas, full of good works? So much so that everyone feels the gap when you leave. That moving scene. Peter arose and went with them. When he had come, they brought to him, so he brought him to the upper room, and all the widows stood by him, weeping, showing the tunics and garments which Dorcas had made while she was with them. Christian friend, what will I be remembered for? What I did for myself, or what I did for others? That I was full of good words that didn't come to much, or that I was full of good works that spoke for themselves, and the ripples, the blessing, went out. Do you want to be a Dorcas? So useful that God brings her back again. Then walk with the one who went about doing good. Point number two. Decision making. Christian friends, are you taking any big decisions at the moment? Well, maybe there are no big decisions at the moment, but just lots of little decisions. Well, little decisions have a habit of adding to little decisions, and leading to crowning decisions. How can I avoid making bad decisions? Well, come with me to 1 Samuel and chapter 27. You go to the first five books, then Joshua, Judges, and 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 27. And we're with David. Now, David's a fugitive. He's on the run, and he's being pursued relentlessly by Saul. Now, if you read the chapters running up to this, chapters 19 to 26, it's thrilling stuff. It's great reading. There are daring escapes and near misses. But if it's thrilling to read, it's all taking its toll on David. And he's worn down, exhausted, and you wonder, when was the last time he had a good night's sleep? Added to this, chapter 26, he's been stabbed in the back by his own kinsmen, the Ziphites, who spill the beans on him. Added to that, he's got 600 men with their families to care for, as well as his own wives. And added to that, Saul is unrelenting. He's always on David's tail. And with no end in sight, David makes a decision. Time to act. David thinks something's got to change. So chapter 27, verse 1, David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand." Then David arose and went over with 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. I'll go to the land of the Philistines. Saul's never going to look for me there. Now, is that a good decision or a bad decision? Initially, it seems like a good decision. There's now food, shelter, peaceful nights. Certainly, there's been a very warm welcome from Achish and hospitality. And at last, after all this life of a fugitive, David has a bit of normality, some home life, time with his wives, time to relax a bit. And best of all, no more Saul. Good decision, David. But it's not long, if you read the chapter, that tension starts to creep into the narrative. David is welcomed by the Philistine king. The Philistine king thinks that David has changed sides, has gone over to the Philistines. And so David finds himself having to lie, and worse, to cover his tracks. And we find here is David the man of God living a double life. And having won Achish's confidence, David now finds that the Philistine king expects him to go to war against Israel. So verse 12 of 27. So Achish believed David, saying, "He has made his people Israel utterly abhor him. Therefore he will be my servant forever." He's come over to our side now for good. Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, "You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men." Says Achish, "You're going to be fighting on our side. I know that. There's no doubt in my mind that you're on our side now." And the troubles of keeping one step ahead of Saul now seem nothing compared to this. This really is a monumental crisis. And David's kingship is on the line. It's one thing to escape from Saul. It's quite another for Israel's anointed king to march with the Philistines, to go to war against the people of God. This looks like treachery, doesn't it? And now David's fateful decision, that smart move, "Let's go down to the Philistines, Saul's never going to look for me there," that decision now looks like madness. Because either he must go to war against Israel and lose the kingdom, or he must side with Israel and face being slain by the Philistines. You think, David, get out of that. Well, you have to read next to find out what happens. But that decision to go down to the land of the Philistines is madness, isn't it? So where did David go wrong? Well, look at his words. Chapter 27, verse 1. David said in his heart. In other words, David's talking to himself. There's nothing wrong with talking to yourself. We all do it, don't we? But it's what he's saying to himself. David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel. He'll give up ever looking for me. So I shall escape out of his hand." David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul." David is saying to himself, "Saul's going to get me in the end. Saul's going to get me in the end. Saul's going to get me in the end. That was a close escape. Next time he'll get me. He'll get me in the end." And if you say it to yourself long enough and often enough, then soon you'll begin to believe it. But it's the voice of unbelief. David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul." But David, hasn't God promised you the kingdom? Didn't Samuel anoint you as king? Hasn't Saul himself said, "David, I know that you're going to be king"? God has promised you the kingdom. So why are you saying, "I'm someday going to perish by the hand of Saul"? "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines." Who says there's nothing better for you to do? The only person who's saying that, David, is you. What about God's promises, God's way, God's timing? Do you see what's happened? In all the stress of these months, and you cannot but sympathize with David, it's been a nightmare, hasn't it? On the run. But what's happened in all the stress? David has neglected his walk with the Lord. And instead of listening to God's voice, he's listening to his own voice. Instead of taking hold of God's promises, what God has clearly said to him in his hearing through his prophet Samuel, David is now taking things into his own hands. And because he is not walking with the God of wisdom, he makes a foolish, foolish, foolish decision that nearly costs him everything. Now, I don't know if you're like me. But involuntarily, I often have music playing in my head. And the music that plays in my head often matches my mood. Sort of there in the background. I ignore it most of the time, but every now and again I tune in to find out what the song is that's playing in the background. Do you ever do that? Good, some people are nodding, so I'm not the only one. Sometimes you listen to it, you think, what, Elvis Costello. And I would rather be anywhere else than here today. Or the animals. We've got to get out of this place if it's the last thing we ever do. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. So should I listen to that voice? Should I grab Mandy's hand and say, come on, let's run away? So often we have a voice, don't we? A voice in our heads, a voice in our heart. It's speaking to us. It's speaking to you now. Probably thinking, how long is it going to go on for? What's for lunch? Whose voice is it? It's your voice, isn't it? David said in his heart. And if I listen to my voice often enough and for long enough, I will soon begin to believe it. Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than I should speedily escape the land of the Philistines. Then David arose and went. That's exactly that, doesn't he? But you see, if I'm listening to my voice, I'm not listening to God's voice. And if I'm not listening to God's voice, what's going to happen? So, Christian friend, are you like David this morning? Are you under pressure? Have you been worn down? Have you been stabbed in the back? So many cares and worries. And there's no end in sight. And you see, in all the pressure and the upset and the anguish and all the things that have been going through your mind, what's happened? Something has got squeezed out. And all the pressure, you've neglected your walk with God. And now you're saying to yourself, Saul will get me in the end. Saul will get me in the end. Saul will get me in the end. And maybe the devil's there also saying it. Yes, he will get you in the end. Saul will get you in the end. And that's the voice you're now listening to. And already you're making your plans. Well, slow down. In fact, stop. Christian friend, do you hate your circumstances? Do you hate the life that you've got at the moment? You hate every morning. You wake up and think, I hate this life. I don't want to live this life. Why am I living this life? You hate your circumstances. Is your marriage rocky? Are you fed up being single and you've given up of ever waiting for a godly believer? Are your children causing you grief? Is there someone dogging your steps? Are you fed up with APC? You think, oh. Maybe your health is failing. Has it all gone wrong? And you've stopped talking to God. And you've stopped listening to God. And you've stopped communing with God. And now you're just listening to yourself. And there's that voice in your head, that background music, and it won't stop, and it's just going on and on and on. And the voice in your head is getting louder and louder and louder. And you think, I can't go on like this. I can't live like this anymore. I've had enough. I've crossed a line. It's enough. I've got to do something. Something's got to change. Well, Christian friend, whose voice is it? David said in his heart, I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. And is that voice that's in your head? It's pushing you, pushing you, pushing you to do something precipitous. To say, I can't go on like this. It's all got to change. I'm going to do this. And when I do this, Saul will be off my back forever. But you're in danger of running into the embrace of the Philistines. Of forgetting the promises of God. of leaving the safety and the circle of God's people, and in danger of taking things into your own hands. Christian friends, stop. Are you in danger of leaving one set of problems for something far worse that could wreck everything? Now, my voice is unreliable. God's voice is true. So listen to his voice. Don't just remember his voice, but go into the presence of God and listen to his voice. Bring all that is going on, all the anguish, all the months, all the heartbreak, all the impossibility of your situation. Bring that into the presence of God and talk to him about it. And listen to his voice in his presence. Talk about all this next week. Brothers and sisters, finish this verse. What does it say? Something David said. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Let's say it again. The Lord is my shepherd.
I shall not want.
So one more time. The Lord is my shepherd.
I shall
not want. Now listen to that voice. David stopped listening to that, didn't he? The Lord is all I need. And if he is my shepherd, then he is in perfect control. And if he is my shepherd, then he is bigger than my fears. And if I am a sheep, the safest place in the world is to be standing next to the shepherd. Not to think, I know what I'll do. And as my shepherd, his will is perfect. This is the shepherd who has loved me with an everlasting love. And whoever heard of such a thing, a shepherd laying down his life for a sheep? But that's what he did. He so loved me that he shed his blood for me. So it's unthinkable that the shepherd should now abandon his sheep. And if you can't believe it even for that reason, he's the good shepherd. What sort of shepherd would he be if he lost one sheep? It would ruin his name forever, wouldn't it? The praise of heaven would have a discord in it because there was one sheep that should have been there that wasn't there because he didn't do his job as the good shepherd. He leads us in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. He has a name, the good shepherd. He's not going to throw away his name, is he? He's not going to abandon you. And he will work all things for your good and his glory. He is true to his word. Only you must go to him. You must look to him. You must go into his presence and face to face listen to his voice to you. But he's my shepherd. He is all I need. Let that be the voice that you hear. Let that be the voice that goes round and round and round in your head. And if you hear it often enough and long enough, you'll begin to believe it. Christian friends, bad decisions. Whose voice are you listening to? Go direct to God. Follow the shepherd. Walk with the God of wisdom, and you will not make mad decisions. Remember the words of Proverbs? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. You want to know what to do? Go to God. Walk with God.